So what did Bukele say? President Nayib Bukele of El Salvador, he came in and essentially laid out why it is that we have to fight this entrenched political force in our own government. We call it the deep state, call it Washington, you call it back east, what have you. Permanent Washington, what have you. He laid out the evils of this kind of this entity and sort of paints the picture of what they did to his country and lays out the similarities of what they did to El Salvador and what they're currently doing in America right now. To sort of, again, to paint the picture of why exactly these people need to be stopped and what'll happen if we are unsuccessful. Using his own country as the example. And not just as the example of what happens if you fail to stop them, but what happens as the example of when you succeed in overthrowing them and how good it can be for you and why it is beneficial to overthrow them. So not just why it's a good idea to fight them in terms of avoiding the disaster that these people will bring, but laying out why it is also a good thing to overthrow them. What lies on the other side of that? And he paints both of these pictures in his speech. So he opened up his speech with a shot across the bow towards globalism, saying that, quote, "They say globalism comes to die at CPAC. I'm here to tell you that in El Salvador, it's already dead," end quote. Which is, again, indicator of where America is going to go. Globalism will have no place in America as well. And he follows this up by saying, quote, "But if you want globalism to die here too," and we do, "if you want globalism to die here too, you must be willing to unapologetically fight against everything and everyone that it stands for. Fight for your freedom and fight for your rights," end quote. So this is how he opens up the speech, right? And that sets the tone for what he's talking about. He's talking about fighting against the globalists, fighting against these anti-humanist, Satanist, globalists. that's the full name for what they are, the anti-humanist, Satanist globalists. And that's one hell of a way to open up a speech. And so he goes into detail, quote, "The next president of the United States must not only win an election, he must have the vision, the will, and the courage to do whatever it takes, and above all, he must be able to identify the underlying forces that will conspire against him," end quote. And we saw that during the first Trump term, where sure, he won the election, and then you had Russiagate, then you had Ukrainegate, then you had impeachment, and you had people working against his back to keep us from getting out of Syria. You had people working against his back to forestall a withdrawal from Afghanistan. You had all these actors who thought that they knew better working against the president and impeding what should have been the best foreign policy agenda of our lifetimes and still ended up being a pretty solid go at it, but a watered-down version because he did not succeed at getting a grip on these people, these saboteurs, so to speak. So he's absolutely right when he says that. And he talks about how the globalists take over and destroy countries. And he compares this to the boiling frog analogy, where the problems that these people cause seem isolated at first and unconnected, but then they gradually mount and mount and mount until it's too late to stop them. Then you're in a problem, you're in deep shit, and now you can't climb your way out anymore. And in El Salvador, he says that this resulted in a civil war, two civil wars actually, and 50 years of turmoil, which ultimately took the lives of 250,000 El Salvadorians and a third of their population leaving the country, which is a collapse if I've ever seen it. And this is all before they were finally able to regain control of their country with his, not just with his election, but with his triumph over the gangs and the cartels in his country. Where he built the super Arkham asylum to lock them up. And he talked about how crime and gang violence and drug wars are the signs of decline that will lead us, America, to destruction just as it did in El Salvador. And he follows up by explaining the remedy to these ailments, which is the important piece here. He talked about the removal of corrupt judges, attorneys, prosecutors, so that you could facilitate the necessary mass prosecution and incarceration of the gang members who had previously functioned as warlords all across El Salvador. And in our case, America, because we have a similar growing gang problem here, namely with the cartels. And he also says the reason you had to remove these people was because they would use their power in the legal system to set captured gang members free. And that would just perpetuate the cycle of violence and crime. And does that sound familiar? We have all these AGs setting criminals and arsonists free every time the police capture them. And it demoralizes your police forces and makes it seem pointless to enforce the law. And that only makes the problem worse. So we're seeing that in America already. Now he says, let me come back up. He says, quote, unelected bureaucrats are trying to instate public policy. Who elected them? They don't have a democratic mandate. They don't have a democratic mandate. If they want a seat at the table, they should run for office. Let the people vote. It will not be a pretty sight for them if the elections are free and fair. Keywords free and fair. Then he continues saying, quote, I mean, who elected Soros to dictate public policy and laws? Why does he feel entitled to impose his agenda? Let me tell you something. Soros and his cronies hit a brick wall in El Salvador. End quote. So he calls out George Soros by his whole government, and says that he's been stopped in El Salvador. He has been thoroughly stopped in El Salvador, and thus El Salvador can now present itself as a model to other countries seeking to get out from the globalist thumb, with, you know, Soros being the poster child for globalism. Him and Klaus Schwab, of course, being the two poster childs of globalism. El Salvador broke free from their grip. And now El Salvador's leader, the person responsible for taking the country through that change, is now speaking at CPAC and behind closed doors speaking with Trump and other political leaders in America to lay out the groundwork and the game plan for how we can get rid of these people in our own country. And this is what I'm talking about, working with our neighbors to mutual benefit. To our mutual benefit. Because he's already done it. El Salvador has already done it. And now by having a good relationship with El Salvador, they can share the secrets of how to get rid of these parasites from our country. And the result for America is going to be far greater. The consequences of America breaking free from the shackles of globalism and from these people who just want to seek rent, living off of our greatness. The consequences of a free and sovereign America are going to be far more far-reaching than El Salvador. And no offense to El Salvador, they're just a very small country. And America is a great power. It's going to be a political revolution, the likes of which we haven't seen since the American Revolution, which is why I keep calling it the Second American Revolution. But him being here, him laying this out to us, is important. And again, he's going to be going a lot more in-depth behind closed doors with our political leaders in MAGA. This is huge. His presence here is huge. It's going to be consequential. These guys are serious. And that's the lovely thing about it. That's the exciting thing about it. The seriousness of it. Don't get me wrong. The seriousness in the other direction, which is that if we don't succeed, we're fucked. we're fucked if we don't succeed. But the fact that this is happening, this is real, is not just, oh, it's doom and gloom and despair. But no, someone has done it. Someone's broken free, and that someone is now speaking to our political leaders so that we can do it too. And that's what I love about this. That's what I really love about this. So he says, quote, thank God, another glory be to him. Salvadorians are now immune to his influence, and he's talking about Soros. No one believes his lies anymore. We just had free and fair elections, and we won in a landslide with more than 80% of the vote, end quote. And that's a free and fair election is something that Trump is campaigning on, election reform. And that's what he's going to do if we can get over the hurdle of this defense in depth against Americans in our own elections. And it'll be, this election is going to be a very crazy one and a very interesting one to watch. A consequential one, no lie. But Bukele, he also talks about the importance of free and fair elections and how globalists despise free and fair elections and how they try to rig these elections because they can't control the people without controlling the elections. They have to control the elections, present the illusion of democracy so that the people will go along with their installed people, their installed candidates, who will then enact the globalist agenda in opposition to real national interests. And we see the same thing here in America, where our politicians are voting to give hundreds of billions of dollars to a foreign country, and yet our infrastructure is crumbling, our border is wide the fuck open, our people are dying at rates that the Ukrainians, that make Ukraine's losses look modest. I mean, we lose hundreds of thousands of people to fentanyl. And that wouldn't be happening if we closed the border, but no one in our government wants to close the border. We have trade deficits with fucking China. No one wants to get that under control. Our currency is losing value every year. No one wants to get that under control. Like, what are we doing here? So we can see the consequences of this ourselves. And for better or worse, 2020 made it clear that our elections are not free and not fair at all, which makes this election very interesting to watch, because is it going to be free and fair? Is something going to happen to make it free and fair? We don't know. We're very much along for the ride here. But he talks about the importance of free and fair elections, because when you have free and fair elections, these people usually can't win. Yeah, I say usually, because, you know, if they could never win an election, we wouldn't be in these positions that we are in today. But he talks about how these people, once they get in, they start weaponizing the legal system against their political opponents. Sound familiar? He talked about how the importance of a free press and of institutions adhering to their fundamental purpose of serving the people, not just going, we're an institution, so you have to listen to us. He talked about how these are the pillars of a free society. And when talking about the corrupt institutions, he said it's time to erase these new paradigms that have been imposed in the years that make no sense. And he's talking about wokeism in that regard. It's time to erase these new paradigms that have been imposed in the years that make no sense. If you just free your minds from these invisible chains, you could do it. End quote. He also talks about how the greatest threat to America is not a foreign country, but is actually the printing of money by the Federal Reserve, which is the real means by which our government is funded, he says. And he says that this will kill our currency. And what the next president of the United States will need to be ready to do is completely overhaul the federal bureaucracy and federal finance. And his speech goes on just a little bit longer than that, but that is the gist of what he had to say. So again, the most substantive speech at CPAC aside from Milei's, this one about combating the people who have captured our government. And how you have to fight them, what they try to do to stop you, what you need to keep them out of power once you take the power back, and why it is important, why it is a good thing to take power from them, and not just, oh, they're going to do this, that, and the third, and they're so evil, but why is it a good thing to get rid of them, beyond the negatives of what they intend to do? You get sovereignty, and you get to be the ones to decide, the people get to decide who their leaders are, and the future of their country. Very important, and again, so crucial that he is in America speaking to our political leaders about how to get rid of this same cancer that has infected our society and has been based out of our society, quite frankly, because the problems in El Salvador likely emanated from D.C. So the same cancer that has taken root in our country is to blame for what happened to his country. And so now we get the American nations coming together to fight against this malignant behemoth. Starting with El Salvador, moving on to Argentina, Mexico to a certain degree, they're trying to join the BRICS. Brazil, to a certain degree, they're in the BRICS. You can bit by bit see the Western Hemisphere breaking free from this globalist mechanism of control, and it's all leading up to the abolition of globalism in America. That's the key thing here. Because America is the sort of... Well, I'd say Europe is sort of the epicenter of their control, but America is the epicenter of their power. And what I mean by that is that they have more direct control in Europe than they do in America, but America is the source from which they derive their power, because America is an incredibly powerful nation. They wanted to do the same to China, but Xi Jinping didn't let them. They wanted to break up Russia and rape them for their resources, and Putin did not allow them, which is why they hate Putin, they hate Xi, and they hate Donald Trump. So now, we're about to do the same for our country that Nayib Bukele did for his. And that is a political revolution, the likes of which we have not seen since the American Revolution. And thus, it becomes even more appropriate to call this the second American Revolution. And now, we'll get into Trump's speech. And then we'll talk about the consequences of this break. This break in what the new American system is going to represent, and how exactly it will lead to the destruction of the idea of Western solidarity. And we'll finally end out this rather extended episode, which I wasn't intending to be this long. I was not intending for that, but alas, I drone on, and those speeches took longer to cover than I thought they were. But Trump's speech was, again, a Trump rally, basically. But a number of things that he said that stood out was that he said that a vote for him was a vote against tyranny, which is nothing new, but he said that our federal government and the three-letter agencies have been weaponized against us, exactly what Bukele said that the globalists like to do when they get into power, and we can see this on full display because of how desperate these people are to stop Trump from getting back into office. Which tells you everything you need to know about who needs to be in power and who doesn't. It tells you everything you need to know. Everyone else is a fraud. That's what it tells you. They're not afraid of Nikki Haley. Oh my gosh, she's gonna beat Biden. She's the candidate we need. No. They're afraid of Trump. And therefore, we need him. I get that people take it too far with like, oh, if Putin or Xi Jinping approved of this candidate in our country, we can't vote for him. Well, it doesn't really matter what they think. Because their opinions they shouldn't hold sway in our domestic politics. Now, for foreign policy, maybe. Maybe it means something. Because you have to interact with these countries in foreign policy. But domestically, we should not be basing our decisions based off of what leader of some other country doesn't like you. That's such a childish way to derive the legitimacy of your candidates. But in the case of a malignant cancer that has usurped our government, if they are afraid of him, that means he's going to lead us back to sovereignty. So them being afraid of him and them trying to cancel him in any way possible is actually a good thing. Because it means that we know exactly who it is we need to vote for. So Trump, he said that these agencies in our federal government have been weaponized against us. And that he will, quote, unleash this captive nation from Joe Biden and his gang of very bad people. Who are, as he says, hell-bent on the destruction of American freedom, end quote. He said this is our last chance to defeat these people, because if we don't, well, he's not getting any younger, and their system is of fortifying elections is only going to get stronger the more they entrench themselves in. And Bukele said it took 50 years to get El Salvador back. if we don't beat these people here and now, we might be looking at a 50-year dark age for our damn selves. And that's the other side of this coin, right? With great optimism comes also great danger, precisely because the optimism comes from who it is that we are removing from power, with the assumption that we're going to move them from power. Because if we fail, well, my goodness, these people are going to rape, rob, and ravage America, and they will not hold back their contempt for the American people. They're barely doing it now. They want to deindustrialize us. They want the population shrunk. And while they won't be able to do it to China, and they won't be able to do it to Russia, they'll certainly try to do it to America. And it'll be a really bitter pill to swallow if we're the only country that fails to break free from them, and we just go down the tubes while everyone else has a sort of golden age in the 21st century. That'll be a really shitty feeling. But so goes the importance of this election. And it's going to get crazy. Like, I hate to be that guy, oh, this is the most important election of our lifetimes. The line gets overused a lot. And I do mean a lot. But given that we finally have a real, legitimate chance of overthrowing this malaise in our government and having real sovereignty again, real elections again, and for the American people to finally be back in control of their government, I think that given what Trump represents beyond he's a Republican, I think, and once you factor in who it is that he is fighting against, not the Democrats, but this globalist cabal, if you will, I think this is perhaps the most important election of our lifetimes. Of course, we're going to have to wait and see about that. I'm just saying that because of what I think and what I believe. But that's going to be observed rather than, you know, extrapolated from the moment. Because we don't know. Maybe things get worse. Maybe these people try to make a comeback later on, and then that becomes the more like... But, you know, the line does get overused, so it loses its potency. But that being said, I do think this is going to be a very, very consequential election, and a very entertaining one to watch. So, Trump, talking about getting rid of these people, he says that at the ballot box this November will deliver a reckoning like they haven't even imagined before. We're going to straighten out our country. We're going to bring our country back for hard-working Americans. We're going to bring our country back. For hard-working Americans, November 5th will be our new Liberation Day. But for the liars and cheaters and fraudsters and censors and imposters who have commandeered our government, it will be their Judgment Day. End quote. Now, these are powerful words that we haven't heard from him before. We've heard him say, I am your retribution, I am your vengeance, I am a lot of things. We haven't heard that. And in the context of what some of these other speakers have been saying, I think that that holds a lot of weight. November 5th will be our new Liberation Day. Now, why does he say November 5th and not election November 5th through 12th? You know, because we don't have election day anymore. It's election week. Why does he say that with such confidence? Like, it's going to be an election day. I'm not sure. Maybe events will play out and we'll find out later on down the line. But I think it's odd for someone who got cheated out of an election to not assume that they were going to cheat a second time. And given that it was election week and election month last night, well, election fortnight, quite literally an election fortnight, I don't see why he would assume that it wouldn't be an election fortnight this time. Why does he think that November 5th, a single day, will be our Liberation Day? Why won't it be Liberation Week or Liberation Fortnight? You know, just small little details like that. Small little details like that that give hints about what he's anticipating. And for the rest of us, we'll just have to play the wait-and-see game. But he also says, quote, when we win, the curtain closes on their corrupt reign, and the sun rises on a bright new future for America. That's what we have to have. I believe it's our last chance. The more this corrupt establishment tries to stop us, the more you know the day is near at hand when we will break free from their grip. We will break free from their grip very soon. These are powerful words. This is the substance of his speech. Yeah, again, the rest of it was more like a Trump rally where he goes through his usual stand-up comedy routine. But this is the substance of his speech. You know, in between the comedy, in between him being, you know, the guy that, for better or worse, is the guy, this is the substance. This is the serious side. This is him, our glorious leader, laying out what it is that is at stake and what it is that we are fighting for. A glorious new future for our country that works for hardworking Americans. Our new Liberation Day. Now, how exactly he can be so confident it'll be our Liberation Day and not another massive disappointment like 2020 was, I don't know. I don't know why he's so confident. I really don't. I can't tell you. But I can say that perhaps he knows something we don't. And perhaps the congregation. That's what perhaps the congregation of all these major voices, of Milei, of Bukele, of Trump, of Matt Gaetz, and a number of other major voices within the MAGA movement. Perhaps all these forces coming together at this CPAC. And, of course, Carrie Lake as well. You know, she had firsthand experience of getting cheated in Arizona. Perhaps this congregation of these minds who are all united in opposition, concrete, material opposition to the globalists, perhaps that will have an impact that we just have to wait and see to, you know, understand in full what that impact is. Because we really don't know. We're completely in the dark here. Either they know something we don't, or we're all fucked. And we're just going along for the ride where we're taking our white pills just to get disappointed in a matter of months. Because, you know, it's almost March now. This year is going by decently fast. And, you know, it was not the case with 2020. Oh, God. 2020 was slow. And that was so before COVID. But alas, this is what we're looking for. And he also reiterated his commitment to the largest deportation operation in history to get rid of all these imported actors and people who shouldn't be in our country. Like, there's this argument from the left saying these people need a pathway to citizenship. Well, no, there's already a pathway to citizenship, and it's called legal immigration. So that's going to happen. And it's, again, this is a revolution. This is a political revolution. In the literal sense this time. Some people like to argue that the American Revolution wasn't a political revolution because we didn't overthrow the crown, except we did. We overthrew them within our locale, which was the 13 colonies. And we're looking at another political revolution here where instead of the crown, or maybe it is the crown if you connect the dots a little, City of London. But this revolution, we're going to be overthrowing the globalists who have embedded themselves into our federal government. And part of that is going to be a new national system where the power of the federal government is checked and balanced by a renewed power of the states. And you can see that being exemplified with Texas and Florida leading the way in that regard, with other states following. Again, 26 states sent their National Guards to go support Texas. And this won't be the end of the resurgence of state power in our federation. We're going to go back to a true Republican, small r, system of governance where the states are, you know, a counterbalance to the federal government. And you get a real system of checks and balances, a real republic. And that's going to be, again, a political revolution because of how far away from our Constitution we've moved. We're going back to the Constitution. And it's going to be great for us. It's magnificent. It's truly magnificent, this second American Revolution that we're living through. and I think that it's heading in all the right directions. Against the UN, against globalism, removing the rotten corruption of our own federal government, returning the power to the people through legitimate elections, back to capitalism. Back to capitalism as the more moral and humane system of economics from which you can have a free society through free economic interaction between peoples within our country. Citizenship meaning something again by removing all these illegal immigrants. And Trump talks about the baby boom and the reindustrialization of the United States. This is everything going in the right direction. And NATO, well, he's openly critical of NATO, and he's not going to be the last. And aside from a number of, I would say, arguably aside from some less than desirable foreign policy positions, Trump is the guy. And he will oversee this political revolution towards this brighter future for America, which I'm very confident in. But that brighter future doesn't happen in a vacuum, because before Trump can come in, you have the people who are here now and what they're doing and the consequences of what they do, which will be longer term, maybe not in America, but certainly in other places around the world, specifically Europe. Because in light of all this, in light of this new national vision for America's future, a sort of pan-American future, because a lot of the speakers here influencing this come from the Americas. Notice, I'm pretty sure the only major foreign leader aside from Latin America who showed up was Nigel Farage of Britain. And Britain's probably going to be in America's orbit in the new order. But America's future is largely going to be right here in the Americas, working with Argentina, working with El Salvador, perhaps even, and working with Mexico as well, with Guatemala and the other countries for our own border security, and that'll blossom into something more, especially as we start becoming a major oil producer again. And depending on who Trump surrounds himself with, we might even see a new approach to Cuba and Venezuela. I'm hesitant to say that we will, but that might be in the cards given the reorientation of American foreign policy based on this political revolution inside the United States. And let's not forget that when Jair Bolsonaro was in power in Brazil, you had a stronger U.S.-Brazil relationship in South America as well. So in the event that he comes back to power, which there's no guarantee that he will, but in the event that he does, you're looking at a true pan-Americanism being manifested through these various political revolutions in these countries, overthrowing the establishment of each nation and returning power to the people, which is a phenomenon that is overlooked when it comes to the Americas, but and is hyper-focused on when you're looking at Europe. I don't think America's future is in Europe. I think it's right here at home. But what America is doing in Europe right now is going to have consequences for the Europeans, because in light of all this glory that America is heading towards with our final battle, as Trump calls it, against the deep state, Yorktown 2024, as I like to call it, in light of this is the deliberate destruction of Europe being undertaken by the current people in charge, the swamp, if you will, the globalists, who's, remember how I said that they have more direct influence and power in Europe. They can exert more power directly onto the Europeans, even though the source of their strength is America, right? So you have the two epicenters here, the two hemispheres of this brain, where America is the muscle and Europe is captured. And they maintain their grip on the Europeans because, well, that's where a lot of these globalists live. That's what a lot of these globalists live. America is sort of, America is captured by a foreign entity, and that foreign entity bases itself primarily in Europe. And the Europeans, while they are fighting back, and you have the farmers' protests all across the continent, they have to live with these policies and they're going to have to live with them for longer than America will. And that's not just because it's going to take them a bit longer to free themselves from the shackles of globalism, but because of what the American government under the globalist regime is doing to them. So it's this destruction of Europe, because we know that it's there, we know what is happening. But I would argue, in light of this new pan-American future for the United States, that this destruction of Europe, combined with the shift of America away from Europe, is going to destroy this idea of the West. And when I say the West, I'll clarify that I do not define that term in the same way that literally everyone else does. And there's a reason for that, but I feel that I have to clarify this so that you don't so that you understand where I come from. The West, the way most other people use that term, they use it in a singular, where all the nations, Europe, America, of Europe plus America, plus the Anglosphere, you know, Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. The way that other people use the term the West has with it the assumption that all these countries are all the same civilization, right? Similar to how you'd refer to China or India or Egypt as being a singular, contiguous civilization that has a singular history and a singular culture. That's the way people use the term the West, or the West, the collective West. They're sort of interchangeable. I do not agree with that interpretation of the West. I do agree that there is Western civilization. But I argue that the West is a plural and a distinction that refers to the many civilizations within said distinction. The West, to me, is more accurately used in the same vein as the way you use the terms Eastern or Middle Eastern, because these are distinctions that capture a multitude of civilizations inside of them, because these civilizations, while they do have certain characteristics that are the same, these are distinct from one another. But they're all Eastern, they're all Middle Eastern, like Sumeria, or Assyria, or Persia, or the Ottoman Turks, or hell, the Egyptians. These are all examples of, or the Arabs and the Arab Caliphates. These are all examples of Middle Eastern civilizations. They're all Middle Eastern, but you would not say that the Middle East is a singular contiguous civilization, to sort of give you an idea of what I mean here. I argue that England, France, and Germany are, and the Nordic countries, the Norse peoples, I argue that Rome and Greece and the Russians and to an extent the Italy that was born in the Renaissance following the fall of Rome, these are all separate civilizations. There are almost as many civilizations in Europe as there are nations, and that can be explained by the fact that there are so many nations in Europe. The geographic breakup of Europe and the cultural breakup of Europe, with culture being the basis of civilization, enables there to be so many distinct civilizations in Europe, which up until the discovery of the New World, Europe was the West. So I argue that there are a lot of civilizations in the West, and that the West cannot refer to a singular civilization because, you know, Greece, if it is to be the birth of Western civilization, the Greece of Athens is not even relevant as a comparison to what we now call the West. But for more on my thoughts on Western civilization and how I would define civilization, I refer you to my second anniversary episode. But alas, I'm not referring to that interpretation where everything is a singular. I'm referring to the second interpretation, which is that the West is a where the West is a plural. But this idea that the West as a singular collective, right? This idea that most other people will use when they refer to this term. This singular collective that America is obligated to care for and defend because we're all Western, we're all in this together. I believe that this idea will be an immediate casualty of the destruction of Europe, starting with the loss of the war in Ukraine. And I'm, of course, referring to the economic sabotage that we've witnessed in Europe since the Russo-Ukrainian war began, starting with the bombing of the Nord Stream pipelines, and then the 30,000 or so people who died in Europe to the cold because energy prices were soaring and Europe wasn't getting natural gas from Russia. People died because of that. It wasn't reported on very much, but people died because of that. And you can see the backlash for this rising in various political parties. And this is 2022 to 2023. We don't even know what the numbers are for this winter yet, but it's there. The food and energy prices in Europe are through the fucking roof. I mean, people are paying more on groceries than they make in their check. There was that story from Britain where people were basically back to bartering because they didn't have the money for their groceries. And it's like, what the hell is happening here? And all throughout this war, we've heard the stories of European industries picking up and moving to other places around the world, some of whom going to the United States due to those very same high energy costs caused by the destroying of the Nord Stream pipelines, which we did. The United States, whether you want to blame it on the globalist regime who is currently in charge, or if you want to just say America for short, however you put it, we did that. We destroyed Nord Stream. We instigated this war in Ukraine. And we used our power over our vassal states, the Europeans, to get them to waste all of their military equipment and to waste tens of billions of dollars on a war in Ukraine that was a lost cause. And in the aftermath of this, we're going to walk... Not only are we going to blame them for not spending enough on their military, because that's, you know, the acceptable position in America on the right, not only are we going to blame them for not contributing more, but we're also going to turn around and say that, you know, maybe NATO isn't worth what we thought it was. And then we're going to walk away and embrace our pan-American future while rejecting globalism and NATO. Imagine that. Imagine being a European after America forced your government to do all these things and sacrifice everything for Ukraine, and then watching America leave NATO, leave the UN, go home, and do better than it has done in a century. On the other side of the... Content to be on the other side of the ocean and never come back. After ruining you as a nation, as a country, you're never going to forgive America. You're never gonna forgive America. And as conditions get worse in Europe, this, which is, you know, the worsening of conditions manifesting itself by the farmers' protests all across the continent, the Europeans will increasingly place the appropriate blame on America for what we did to them. And the fallout of this betrayal will run deep, it will run hard, it will be wide-reaching, and it will be long-lasting, and I don't think enough people are really considering this. Probably because a lot of people think that the West is an indefinite thing, and they still believe Ukraine has a chance of winning the war. But the fallout from this is going to be long-lasting, very long-lasting. Europe is not going to forgive us for what we did to them. There will be no room for America on the other side of this. Precisely because the Europeans won't want America to stay. They're not going to want us to stay. And thus, this breakup, this divorce, this the end of the transatlantic era. Right. The end of that world order, which in and of itself is a form of globalism, that break and the return of America to a national system that this time is more pan-American in its nature rather than pan-European or pan-Pacific, just a completely not even considered route that America could take as a nation is exactly what we're going down right now. This break and the destruction and devastation of Europe as we leave them to their own devices. As they blame us for what happened over these last few years. It's going to be the end of this idea of the West. They won't forgive us for what we did. And Europe cannot maintain any kind of unity without some external power forcing it on them. The Soviets are gone, and the Russians aren't going to do it. They don't want to do it. They quite frankly, are fed up with the Europeans. And we are too. So without the Soviets to occupy the Europeans, and without America there to occupy the Europeans, European solidarity dies. And with the break between America and Europe, and then the subsequent collapse of European solidarity, so too will collapse this idea of Western solidarity. It's over. It's over. And thus, the end of this artificial identity, which my country has been labeled with since the start of this Russo-Ukrainian war. How many times did you hear the word Western before the war in Ukraine? Now you hear it all the time, which tells you how artificial it is. I mean, look, I don't have anything against the Europeans, aside from the obvious criticism of my country shouldn't be obligated to defend you, and it doesn't make sense for me to be doing that. But I'm not a Westerner. I'm not a Westerner. No, I'm an American, thank you very much. Nothing more, nothing less. My government is for me. I shouldn't have to share a government with the Europeans because we're all Western. They don't share their government with me. Why should I have to share my government and my government's attention span with them? Who are they? They're not citizens of this country. Oh, they're our Western. Well, they're our allies. They're democracies. That does not have anything to do with me. No. My government, my military, my money is for me. They're all for me. They're all mine. I'm not stingy for saying that. That's just the way it is. All these things are mine. Not for you, not for Ukraine, not Israel, not Taiwan. And it's high time that we got our priorities in order. And by the looks of it, those priorities are going to get put into order very quickly. And the casualty of that's going to be this fake identity, the West. And this fake concept of Western solidarity. But that, for the Europeans, might be a bitter pill to swallow. For us, it'll be the most glorious of days. But that, my lovely listeners, is all I have for you today. I do hope you've enjoyed today's extended broadcast on my geopolitical podcast. The world is changing. We're just along for the ride. But no matter how much the world changes, we will have fun watching that change together. Now, I've been your host, Aishan Wade, and you've been listening to This Week in Geopolitics. So, till we meet again next Monday, Servus.